Conor White-Sullivan is director of Huffington Post Labs. That's basically the technological end of the online news site that recently won the Pulitzer Prize for journalism. Now, when he was in college 4 years ago, Conor set up Localocracy, an online community where people discuss issues that matter to them, and subsequently sold it to AOL. He's interested in how the internet can shape democracy, and particularly in exploring its use across the world in global movements and events like the Arab Spring. First of all, Conor, tell me a little bit about Huffington Post and what you do there.
Huffington Post is now one of the largest news sites in the world. We just celebrated our 7th birthday. It began originally with Arianna Huffington, who is an influential figure out in the United States, pulled together a group of her friends to start a group blog in the early 2000s. And it was originally aggregating and blogging. But over the last 7 years, it's grown monumentally. We've got a large original reporting staff, which is where we won the Pulitzer from. But the goal of the Huffington Post is to help people find the best of the web as soon as they land, and to also maintain that editorial voice. So it's a site where people can, on whatever subject area, they know that they will find the most important news of that day, whether we write it or whether we link out to it or whether it is someone who is using the platform to express their opinion.
And there's huge variety within it. I know that you yourself have cited the baby elephant plays the harmonica. Could be alongside a story about the Arab Spring.
We think that we should both be entertaining and lighthearted. There's a special sort of voice that comes with Huffington Post. We don't take ourselves too seriously, but we try to cover the news that's most important of that day and the issues that are going to really be important across the country. So, for instance, we have more than 20 original reporters out in the United States covering the impacts of the recession right now. So there's always been a focus on the things that we felt were truly and deeply important, but we also try to keep the lighthearted spirit to make sure we keep people coming back so they find those stories too.
Tell me a bit about Localocracy then, how that came about.
In 2008, I'd been studying culture and I was interested in how the web was changing things. I was interested in how things like Wikipedia were forming and people were coming together and being somewhat collaborative. So I ended up getting a job as a political organizer, going door to door, originally talking about environmental issues. Then I moved to Virginia in 2008 to help open a voter registration office. And what I became really interested in was I found people really knew what was going on in their community, sometimes a lot better than their elected officials did. And I was interested in how you could sort of aggregate the best ideas from a town and give people the ability to influence their leaders and visualize the political will of where the town wanted to go. So we built an online town common that would crowdsource the best ideas from a community, the best pros and cons for any issue. These were issues usually about education or taxes or roads or properties or things like that. And we would confirm that they lived in the town so that they could then influence what the local elected officials were doing. That was how we got our start, but then ended up working in the local media space and working with news organizations that had been slashing their budgets on reporting and helping them sort of supplement their coverage of towns with user-generated content from influential figures.
So how does it work? You throw a topic out there or do the topics come in organically from the public?
We would launch in communities, especially where we had buy-in from elected officials, where we had a city councilor or a school committee member who really wanted to understand what people cared about. And issues would come from those elected officials who wanted to sort of poll their public, or they would come from regular citizens who were just interested in raising an idea or putting something into the public domain. Or sometimes they would be like, official ballot questions or things that would be on the ballot when people went in to vote. So issues would come from all over the place. But then as we progressed, we would help these news sites build robust communities of people contributing content and use reputation to sort of figure out what people were interested in, what people were knowledgeable about various subjects. That was what we were doing up until we were acquired.
Just explain crowdsourcing. What's that about? Is that about identifying issues that people are concerned about in a broader issue?
Sort of trying to tap the wisdom of the crowd or raise the best ideas from your audience. Our belief was that the beautiful thing about the internet is your audience doesn't have to just be passive readers or passive listeners. Even in a news organization like the Huffington Post, where we have close to 100 original reporters, none of us have won a Nobel Prize, but we have bloggers on our site who have won Nobel Prizes, who've won Nobel Peace Prizes, or who have won Nobel Prizes in physics or math. And that's just one example. The other example, goes down to someone's mother who has a life story that is special or important. And when people can speak about their own expertise or their own life experience, they're often the most knowledgeable on that topic. So we try to tap the knowledge that's out there and not just be the voice on high speaking down to the rest of the people on telling them what's happening and what's important.
And how does that translate, though, to political influence? Does it actually impact on policymaking, on decision making, or is it just a talking shop?
Traditionally, the media has always sought to have an influence on public policy. I think the powerful thing right now is that as media is being democratized, the potential to influence public policy is also being democratized. We focused originally with Localocracy on the local level because that was where, you know, one person's voice could have the greatest influence. But I would say Huffington Post has also had some sort of influence on at least the things that are spoken about in the public domain. We recently had one of our reporters won an award, a Sydney Award on social justice. He was one of the first people to hop on the Trayvon Martin case down in Florida and did the traditional role of a journalist. You find the important story and you cover it from every angle and don't let up on it. And as a result, that became a major story nationwide. So I think there's still that role of the reporter finding the story and staying on it until the whole world is talking about it. But there's also something for bringing ideas from the people and giving regular people a platform for talking about the issues that they think matter.
Is credibility an issue for online journalism? Because there is a perception that, you can get a lot of conspiracy theories, a lot of wild content that really doesn't have to be substantiated in the way that traditional media, print and broadcast, are required to do.
That's one of the reasons I think Huffington Post is a very interesting place, is because we take all of the potential and sort of power of crowdsourcing, but we also try to maintain that credibility. And we do have a whole team of blog editors, for example, but we do insist that there aren't claims of libel. We do insist that they aren't doing conspiracy theories or putting things out there. We do insist that they have fact-checked their stories and that there is substantial claims there. So that's one of the reasons that people want to blog on Huffington Post, is because we still have the credibility of a traditional news agency, even though we have also let a portion of our site up for regular people to try and contribute.
Now, you know, social media is credited with the Arab Spring and also, of course, the opposition to Putin. How do you see that developing in the future?
What's significant about social media, especially with the Arab Spring, is that it's not so much that it caused people's desire to go out. People had been in opposition to the leaders in these Arab countries for some time, but it allows people to know that other people are also in opposition. So it's not just that, like, I know that I am frustrated, but when I know that you are frustrated and I know that you know that I am frustrated, then I know that we will all go out together. There's a potential for people to be aware of their sort of collective self-interest and that they will have support from other folks when they go out. So I think that's one of the reasons that social media has been really powerful.
And tell me about your Change Your Mind initiative. That's quite interesting.
This was the first outward-facing product that Labs has come up with. We've always been interested in creating that robust place for dialogue and for back and forth. And what we were interested in was, could we take a new approach to online debates? A lot of news organizations have done debates. New York Times and Washington Post and all of them have made an attempt in that space. But when we looked around the broader landscape, we felt like there was something else that was out there. And what we were really interested in was, are people just going and voting the way that they had felt before they read any of the information? Or are people actually being influenced by the points that people are raising? So what we did was, we wanted to take the sort of traditional Oxford-style debate of, you know, you vote before you see the arguments and you vote after and you open yourself up to potentially having your mind changed. So we've seen some really interesting debates there. We've seen the mayor of New York debate a conservative activist on the Stand Your Ground laws, and people would vote before and they'd vote after, and we'd be able to declare the winner based on who had changed the most people's minds. So even if you had, in many situations, people had a less popular opinion, but they were articulate and raised interesting points that people hadn't considered before, and so they were able to win people over to their side. And we felt like that was a powerful way to do debates.
Yeah, no, because I think you observed that there was more of a concentration of like-minded opinion since the 70s. Did you talk about people in political echo chambers? Do you think this is a way to alter that then?
There's plenty of statistics that show that when people are presented with facts, when people are presented with new information, especially if they are feeling afraid or if they are nervous about themselves, the new information will actually make them more dead set in their beliefs, which is a danger, I think, to our whole goals as a journalistic organization of finding truth and presenting truth. So when people are able to open themselves up to seeing new information, when they're able to detach their beliefs from their self-worth and the beliefs that they have about themselves, then you can have people actually engage in a more rational sort of dialogue. So I think it's important for us to keep that in mind when we're trying to inform the public, trying to engage the public in the issues that matter, that you have to ease them into new information.
Now, I know you're of the view that it is better for a topic to be debated without being settled rather than settled without being debated. But that's often a luxury that countries like Ireland, for instance, can't afford, because there's obviously huge opposition to certain decisions that the government has had to make because of austerity. There's no point in talking about them. They're going to happen anyway.
There's always going to be a place for leadership. There's always going to be a place for making the hard decisions that the public doesn't agree with. But if you do too much of that, that can easily fall into the world of dictatorship. And I don't think anyone in a Western democracy would like to see that happen. So the goal that we've always had is, how can you speed up that process? How can you help people really understand things quickly, really engage in that debate quickly? Because right now, if you look at, for instance, the United States, there's so much political gridlock. It's so hard for anything to move through that we need to find ways that we can pick up the pace and that people can at least engage with one another in a more rational and constructive way instead of the 60 votes to get through Congress sort of thing.
Do you see that as a role for journalism then, to encourage people to engage and to make them feel that they are part of a process rather than maybe just simply informing?
Exactly. Especially when you look at online media, I think that's the real potential there is we can tell people a story, we can maybe influence people's opinion, but when we can provide them an opportunity to make a difference of their own or move things forward in some sort of way, then I think that's the huge opportunity that the internet provides, because we don't have to just be passive consumers. We can actually engage on these issues, whether it's calling your elected officials or doing something in your own community to move things forward. There's a huge potential of the internet to help facilitate those things.
Is your own motivation, is it more political than media-based? Are you trying to move along political engagement, or are you coming at this from a journalistic point of view?
I think we're facing extremely important challenges. I think as technology advances, those challenges are only going to become more difficult. You know, when you look at the pace of globalization, the pace of technological innovation, what matters to me is a robust democracy that can handle that and that can innovate from a public good perspective. So what's important to me is the various ways we facilitate people becoming agents in their own life, agents in their own community. And I happen to think that media is one of the most important places for that to happen, where people can, you know, robustly engage on the issues that matter. So I care about media and I care about the foundations of democratic society. And that's why I sort of work in the news. But I don't think I would necessarily fit with the journalists of the 1950s in terms of political mindsets.
You're director of labs at Huffington Post. That's technological, obviously.
Yes.
You describe yourself as a civil technologist. Just tell me what else you're working on.
I care a lot about how we don't just tell people stories, but we help people find the other people who are most knowledgeable about the issue that they're working on, whether that's from the public perspective or people interested in finding experts on various other aspects of their life. So that's one of the reasons that for the Labs Group, which, you know, we're focusing on trying to invent the future of news, we care a lot about that and care a lot about high-quality user-generated content. Since Huffington Post was founded, it's one of the most active online communities in existence. So there's a huge potential there. There's a huge potential of stories that can be unlocked and wisdom that can be unlocked from the crowd. So in general, that's an area that I'm deeply interested in.
Would you ever buy a newspaper?
Yeah, I bought a newspaper last week. I didn't have Wi-Fi in my hotel, so.
Do you think newspapers are done and dusted?
I wouldn't be putting all my money into print pulp and paper factories. There's something nice about the format of newspapers in terms of that you can open it up really wide. That's one of the reasons people are so interested in the iPad right now. And I think you'll eventually see iPad-like devices that you can unfold and you can open up wide. And the same way you would read a newspaper, you'll be able to do that with maybe transparent devices or things like that. But I think the medium is not as important as the type of interaction that you can have with the information, the type of interaction you can have with a public who also is reading the same sort of thing that you're reading. So I don't think journalists are going away, although we might see less people working in paper mills.
And do you think the same rules apply to online reporting as they do to the traditional media?
There are new roles that have come up. So, you know, you wouldn't have seen community managers. You wouldn't have seen people focusing on user-generated content or social media editors. We have all sorts of positions that would never have existed in a newsroom 20, 30 years ago. But I think when you look at the original reporting that we do, you know, we have people that have come from the New York Times. We have people that have come from the Wall Street Journal. We have plenty of people who have established backgrounds. And, you know, they would say that they're able to exert their craft in even a greater way than they could at those places, because we don't have to necessarily put a word limit on the stories that they write. So there are certain things that will never change, but you have to also make room for innovation and the things that are changing every day.